Good afternoon. Good early evening. Welcome to all students. Boys and girls. I am delighted to welcome you all. Thank you. You're right. Tell them to keep quiet. I'm delighted to welcome you all. My name is Abe Fuchs. I'm a member of the Faculty of Medicine. I'm thrilled to be here with you once again for the third in our series. How many of you are new tonight who have not been here before? There are a few. We're delighted to have more people. There's room at the front. I'm going to do research one day on why students don't like to sit at the front of the class, but it's certainly anecdotally true. So we have for you in our series a somewhat different approach tonight. We've talked about the health professions and how important they are. We started with a session by Dr. Raz on cognitive science and hypnosis, where we talked about a discipline and a way of seeing the brain. Last week, by Dr. Sean Clark, we talked about a profession, a healthcare profession, nursing. And he explained to us all what nurses do and how they do it. Tonight, we're using a slightly different approach. We're actually talking about a specific illness. As you'll hear, anorexia, bulimia, eating disorders. And we're going to use that as a model to show you, A, how illnesses are complex. They involve biology, they involve sociology, they involve environment, they involve our cultural ideas about food and beauty. There's an aesthetic dimension. All those things are crucial to what the illness is about. And understanding the illness requires brain science, psychology, genetics, epigenetics, cultural anthropology, and so treating the illness, that is, once you begin to slowly understand it, treating the illness, you will see, requires psychologists, dietitians, nutritionists, social workers, nurses, rehabilitation specialists, psychiatrists. There's a huge array. And this is a good model, because when any disease or any illness is complex, it involves many factors. It also involves many therapists, many investigators, and many healthcare professions to help the individuals deal with that illness. We're very fortunate tonight to have Dr. Howard Steiger to tell us about eating disorders. Dr. Steiger is a psychologist by training. He did his doctoral work here at McGill in our psych department. He then went on and joined the Department of Psychiatry, and in fact, he's now a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and also is appointed in the Department of Psychology. He has developed over many years, actually since 1986, the Eating Disorders Clinic at the Douglas Hospital, which is the largest eating disorder clinic for adults in Quebec. His work with patients, his research, has led to many publications that you will see on the website if you look at that. He's also an editor of a journal, and there are journals, you will learn over time, dedicated to eating disorders. There's even an academy for eating disorders, and that academy gave Dr. Steiger a leadership award for his work in the field, and he's also received only recently, 2013, an award from the Douglas Hospital in Innovation. But most important of all, Dr. Steiger, through his experience, understands and will share with us all the aspects of eating disorders, and as you see in the acronym, from DNA, TLC, or MTV, we'll figure out what those are by the end of the hour. And I think we're going to learn a lot. One administrative quick point before I invite Dr. Steiger up is that the booths, the information booths, with these wonderful students helping us understand the different healthcare professions, they're going to be here next week, and that's it. So if you want to learn more from them, make sure you take advantage of it next week when you arrive and participate. There are no more tours at the M&I. Those were all done. But again, you see there are seats available for your friends, and make sure that you invite them and tell them to come and register and share these wonderful evenings with us. So I'm delighted to invite Dr. Steiger to come up and explain the acronyms and tell us about this fascinating illness. Howard.
This one not?
Yeah.
Did you turn it
on?
I did.
Red light on? 644825.
Well, while we're here, if I speak at this mic, can you hear me?
Okay, good.
I am delighted to be in that series. It's always fun for me to do these kinds of talks. And especially, I'm a little biased, but I kind of have an interest in eating disorders, and I hope that you'll find by the end of the evening some interest in it, too. You're going to see that I also have an interest in genetics and epigenetics. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but you're going to get a little mini lecture tonight in epigenetics as well, which is very relevant to eating disorders, as I hope you're going to see. So we're going to understand anorexia and bulimia nervosa, and as Dr. Fuchs mentioned, we're really going to ask throughout this talk, the question of, is it DNA, obviously genetic factors that explain eating disorders? Many people don't think eating disorders have a heredity, but we'll talk about that. TLC, you know the acronym, right? Tender Loving Care. How much is this a familial kind of phenomenon? Finally, MTV, music television. Do social pressures have to do with it? So it wasn't at the end of the talk that you were going to understand these acronyms, but you get them already. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, let's not make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. You all know what anorexia nervosa is, right? It's this thing where people refuse to eat and make themselves emaciated. Their families become anxious, friends become anxious. People say, eat, eat, and people just refuse to do so. To understand that, think of a phobia. I mean, generally speaking, it's to simplify anorexia, but somebody with anorexia has a terrible phobia. If I have a phobia of elevators, you can tell me that elevators are safe, but I still huff and puff on my way up to the top floor to meet the big brass in the Faculty of Medicine. And in the same way, somebody with anorexia nervosa knows usually that she's emaciated, she knows she's too thin, she knows the food's not dangerous, but it's just terrifying to eat it. And she does what anybody with a phobia does, is she avoids the situation that makes her so scared. Who wants to feel afraid all day, especially if you've got to eat 3, 4, 5 times a day? Who needs to feel miserable that way? There's two types. We call the restrictive type, people who don't binge or purge, and then the majority of people eventually kind of migrate to bulimia or binge-like symptoms, which lets me introduce the one an important point here. People with binge symptoms aren't gluttons. I always say the only normal thing that my patients do with food is they binge eat because they starve themselves for so long. It's like holding your breath. You do it for 2 minutes if you're good, and then you lose control, right? And I've purposefully shown you a picture of a more mature woman. I guess the stereotype might be adolescent girls, best in the class kind of thing. That really is a myth. The largest number of people with anorexia nervosa that we see is around the age of 28. And you probably know it's primarily a disorder that affects females, one guy for every 10 women or so who will develop anorexia. Bulimia nervosa, that seems like the opposite, right? It's about overeating, constant loss of control, followed by some effort to compensate for the calories you eat, right? So people, I guess everybody thinks in terms of like purging through vomiting, people sometimes abuse laxatives, people do day-long fasts, three-day-long fasts before the next binge episode. I've known people who give blood as a way of purging calories. That's how driven people get to somehow get the calories out or make sure they don't affect their body image. So you can see there's some sort of a close cousinship with anorexia nervosa. So there's also this preoccupation with weight and body image that makes people control their food intake so long that they dysregulate their appetite and start to binge. So again, somebody with bulimia is not a food addict. They're often somebody who tries to go all day long without eating enough. And again, you're going to be talking about maybe one or two guys for every 10 females who have the problems. It's mostly a female thing. There's also something we call binge eating disorder. It's binges without compensation, so people eventually make themselves obese. That's a very common problem. We did a study a couple of years ago in the Montreal region. Women who are 20 to 40 years old, almost 4% meet criteria for binge eating disorder, almost 3% of males. So it's a little bit of a different thing. Two guys for every three women, and it happens in a bit of an older age group. It's not the same thing as you see in anorexia and bulimia. It's a different, more adult population. And just to be complete, ORFID is a new diagnostic category came out. I guess you've heard about DSM-5 maybe is the new diagnostic criteria. You ever know somebody who's like so nuts about the health content of food or the ingredients or whether things are, you know, grown in the ground and, you know, natural in every respect. People sometimes get so preoccupied with that kind of stuff that they can't eat anymore, what we call orthorexia. You know, people are always concerned with the vitamin content of food. That would fall within this thing we call ARFID. Okay? Everybody okay with that? Now, if I were to ask you who on this slide is most likely to have an eating disorder, I hope you see me coming by now. Anybody up there could be a candidate, not necessarily the runway model, not necessarily the kind of thin young lady over here, but literally any of these people. And if you think of binge eating disorder, maybe the guy in the middle, older people as well. The oldest woman I've treated for anorexia nervosa was 72. So don't think it's just adolescent girls. Now, eating disorders are all about like these eating problems, but they're not just about eating, and I want you to know that too. If you have a restrictive eating disorder, half of the time you're going to show a major depression, three quarters of the time in your lifetime. You're going to often show an anxiety disorder. Often upset, you know what obsessive compulsive disorder is, right? Obsessions with bacteria, the compulsion to clean your hands, things like that. Anorexia nervosa is an obsessive compulsive disorder, isn't it? I can be obsessed with weight and body image, and I do compulsive things to, you know, chill out my anxiety. I don't eat. I run around the block 7 times after lunch. I don't eat Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday because I'm going to have to eat with friends on Friday, that type of thing. And as a tendency in terms of personality, you know the drill, right? People tend to be a little bit compulsive, preferring order, sameness, predictability. If you have a friend who has anorexia nervosa, don't say you're going to go see a movie on Friday night and then switch the movie or switch a plan like that. These are people who like things to be predictable, orderly, and aren't real good at kind of switching plans. Okay, binge-purge problems. So now it could be what I call bulimia nervosa, normal weight bulimia, or people who have anorexia with the binge-purge type or even binge eating disorder. When there's binge eating, what I'm going to say here kind of applies generally to that group. Again, you got mood problems, depression, and anxiety. But now, you know what lability is? Like shifts of mood, right? A tendency for mood to be all over the map. Highs and lows within the same day. Parasuicidality, people mutilate themselves or make repeated suicide attempts. Impulsivity, I'm showing somebody doing an act of shoplifting. You have people who can sometimes be reckless behind the wheel or promiscuous sexually or stuff like that. And in about 45% of people who have binge-purge problems, substance abusing. Sometimes, you know, using substances like amphetamines to cut appetite, but often just mood-regulating or thrill-seeking kinds of drugs. Now, I should mention that most people with anorexia of the restricting type fit quite neatly with that kind of portrait you have over on the screen on your left over there. Over on the right, we're talking in the binge purge group, a more heterogeneous group of people, but about a third who will beat that kind of very impulsive flavor spectrum. Okay, let's talk about how we understand the causes. As you see, I have a little touch penchant for the dramatic here. I was going to have like Wagner playing behind this slide. When I started in this field, which is now about, I don't know, 26 years ago, I think, we pointed the fingers at families and especially at mothers. The idea was it was over-involved, overprotective moms, absentee fathers that explained the development of the eating disorder. And I just want to point out that there's a real myth around that. The stereotype, and I underline stereotype, was that families where anorexia occurred were enmeshed, overprotective, over-involved. We thought the idea was that the anorexic daughter, and usually she was a daughter, would mount a protest against the family's over-involvement by saying, you know, you have me in every way, but you're not going to tell me what to eat, and you're not going to tell me what to weigh. Nice idea, but I don't think it really applies to most families where anorexia develops. The stereotype for bulimia was that it was kind of the opposite tendency, disengaged families where there was lots of fighting and hostility and blameful finger pointing and stuff like that. The actual reality is that, you know, eating disorders occur in all kinds of families. It can be families that are well-functioning, that show this impulsive tendency and so on. Okay? Maybe the chaotic or disorganized families have to do with more explaining impulsivity or mood problems in the affected kid, enmeshed families associated with anxiousness in the affected kid, but the family functioning doesn't answer the question, why an eating disorder, really? And in the old days, we used to sort of try to treat the family as though there was a problem invariably with the family, and we had to sort out what they were doing wrong. The current approach is quite the opposite. It's to help the affected daughter and the parents get allied against the anorexia nervosa, and to help everyone in the family know how to talk to somebody or help their daughter deal with mealtime situations and so on. At the end of this talk, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about treatment techniques, so you'll see what kind of things you might want to teach parents who are helping an anorexic daughter recover. Okay, but the current stance is really not to blame families and not to assume that the family caused the eating disorder. It's very guilt-provoking for both the affected daughter and the family to do that, and instead to engage them in the treatment process. Okay, so if it isn't development and it isn't the family environment, let's think about whether there's biology involved. And we're going way back now. It's not even safe before you leave the womb. In the intrauterine environment. This is a little bit complicated. I want you to pay attention, though, because I think it's very interesting. Okay, so try to stay with me or stop me if I've lost you. Procopio and Marriott, a few years ago, did a very interesting study, which has been replicated by other people since this time. They take large samples of twins, okay? And as you can see, there's thousands of pairs of twins. And first we're going to look at, over on the left there, female-female twins, so two girls, right? You're looking at adult twins and asking the question, what's the likelihood that one of them will have anorexia nervosa, okay? If you can see the number in the center there, what's it? It's about 1%, right? 1% of female twins have anorexia nervosa. You know what the going rate of anorexia in the general female population is? 1%. Nothing surprising there. If you look at male-male twins now, okay, two guys, what's the likelihood that one of them is going to have anorexia nervosa? You notice it's like about a tenth as much, right? If you remember before I said there's one guy for every 10 females that develops anorexia nervosa, so there's nothing surprising there either. That's exactly the figure you would expect in male, in any group of males. Everybody's with me? Now look what happens when we look at opposite sex twins. And I want to call your attention particularly to this one. This is a male twin who has a female co-twin. You know, he's sort of innocently lying there in the womb. He isn't doing anything next to a female co-twin. Anybody want to hazard a guess? Like, why would it be that the prevalence for anorexia nervosa in this group of people suddenly rises up almost to as high a level as you would expect in females? It's almost 1%, right? That's 0.6%. Somebody want to take a guess? Sorry?
The male picks up some more female hormones.
great guess. And in fact, that's the hypothesis, is that this guy is bathing in estrogen, right? And is in some ways deprived of exposure to androgen in the way he would had he had a male twin. So that's the hypothesis. And just to sort of support it, let's take it one step further so you don't have to believe that. This is going to look like voodoo. I don't know if any of you know about this finger digit span disparity measure. Intrauterine exposure to estrogen has a tendency to cause the index finger to grow longer. So if you are biologically feminized, there's a tendency for the index finger to be equal to or longer than the ring finger. And people who are biologically masculinized, I mean in the sense of less exposure to estrogen, have the opposite pattern. Okay? Now this looks like voodoo, I'm sure, but it's not. That measure is, I always lose the audience at this point, but please, I don't want to ruin anybody's self-esteem either. This measure is not determinant. It doesn't indicate your value as a man or a woman. Come on back. Okay, stop looking at your hands now. We don't want to develop any obsessive-compulsive behaviors around hands. So, come on, come back. I have to tell you about this. So you have to pay attention again. This measure is actually, although it sounds weird, intrauterine exposure to estrogen is correlated with it. If you have the masculinized pattern, you're probably better at arithmetic and a little more aggressive. I mean, it maps onto all kinds of things that are dimorphic for the sexes. And look at this, a study from my colleague Kelly Klump. The more you are over to the right on these graphs, the more you're feminized on this hand measure. The higher you are on this graph, the more you have eating disorder symptoms. Right hand, left hand. What's the message I want you to take from this? Being biologically female is a risk factor for an eating disorder, having lots of estrogen floating around in you, okay? And especially being in an estrogenized intrauterine environment. Think about it. Eating disorders start after puberty. There's some tendency for them to shut down with menopause. There's a lot of estrogenergic stuff involved. Okay. While we're talking about in utero stuff, perinatal complications. If you have anorexia nervosa, you have a higher likelihood of being born with an umbilical cord around your neck, having hypothermia at birth, being low in reactivity at birth. These are signs that are associated with many kinds of mental health problems. It implies sort of maybe an intrauterine damage in a way to your nervous system. That means you're not able to cope that normally with stress. Bulimia nervosa, smaller babies, hyporeactive at birth. So there's something that can go on even in utero that explains the eating disorders. So are the eating disorders hereditary? You know that when we want to look at heredity, we look at twin studies. And for anorexia, bulimia, that's BN, binge eating disorder, what I'm showing you, those numbers are coefficients of heritability. What it means is, if we want to ask what amount of the effect of two twins having concordance for anorexia or bulimia, or how much of that is due to genes, you can see that the result is usually between about 30% and 80%, on average, let's say 50% of your likelihood of developing an eating disorder is explained by genes. Okay? The other 50% tends to be associated with factors in the environment. So it's a gene-environment interaction. Now we're getting to genes. And now I'm going to put you all to sleep. We've studied various, I don't mean we, well, we do them, these studies too, but you know, around the world, many groups are studying genes that have to do with main brain systems, like dopamine, which has to do with reward, serotonin, you know, it's related to mood and satiety. It's a good player to be likely involved in eating disorders. Estrogen, of course, for the reason I've talked about. And then genes that act on general metabolism, body weight, fat storage, various kinds of things like that. Wherever you see an AN or a BN, I'm just trying to point out that the literature suggests that that particular gene, those funny letters and numbers mean a particular gene, is associated with the risk of anorexia or bulimia. Now, something as complicated as anorexia or bulimia, it ain't going to be due to one gene. Could be due maybe to an interaction among many genes that affect your mood and your ability to control your appetite and maybe your self-esteem and various other things that genes do. So we're going to talk a bit about genes. But for every study that shows that one of these genes is associated with anorexia or bulimia, there's one that shows that they're not. So now already you're going to be saying, this guy's research isn't worth a hell of beans. Why would I be interested in genetic research if we can't link the genes to the disorders, right? And my defense against your complaint about our research is going to be that genetic potentials, you can't think of it as you're carrying a fixed tendency that must be expressed. Genes are, as the metaphor with the light switch implies, they need to be switched on or switched off. And what's interesting to me about eating disorders is I think there are things that particularly can switch on certain kinds of genetic tendencies and problems. Okay, bear with me here. Okay, I promise not to show you too much data, but just to prove the point about a gene-environment interaction. What I've plotted for you here is results from a study we did in our group. So hundreds of women with bulimia and an almost equal number of women who don't have bulimia. And we've divided them into four different groups. These are adult women who carry or don't carry, it's called the glucocorticoid receptor gene, but you don't need to know, this is a gene that controls how able you are to accommodate stress. Okay? If you have one version of it, it's called the C, you're not good at accommodating stress. And if you have the other version, you're a little more stress adaptable. Okay? We've also divided these women in terms of whether they... Whoops, I think we've lost the... Okay. It'll come back? Okay. Has it been coming and going behind my back as I'm talking?
No.
Okay.
Only once.
Only once. Well, it's actually not a stress test. It's a test of your memory. Can you remember where those bars were? Okay, we've divided these women into those who do or don't have a genetic potential to be bad stress accommodators and those who report childhood abuse. Okay? Those who did or did not experience a very severe stressor during childhood. Okay? I know there's been lots of distractions. Are you all still with me? Okay, look at the bar over here on your right, because that's the important one. That's the group that has the bad gene and the bad environment. Okay? Where you see red, that's women who have bulimia. You notice that that column's kind of red, right? More women with bulimia have that combination of bad, the genetic problem with responding to stress and the bad environment. So you're talking about a gene environment susceptibility to the development of a disorder. Okay. So this is cool, I think. Gene environment interactions is very interesting. But now we're going to go a little more into this. By what magic do genes talk to the environment, or does the environment impact on genes? It's not an obvious thing, right? And that's where epigenetics comes in. Raise your hand, please. How many of you are familiar with epigenetics? Okay, some of you. Good. Epi is a Greek prefix which means above. Okay, so we're talking about something that works above the genome. It kind of controls the genome. And here I'm going to show you my kind of silly understanding of epigenetics. Think of a piano keyboard. It's a fixed thing, right? It has 88 keys. It's always going to have 88 keys. But depending on which keys you depress or don't, you can do a lot of variations in terms of music, right? So obviously, think of your genome now as a, 35,000 key keyboard. And there are environmental markers, the ways in which the environment actually plays on your 35,000 keys. And I'll try to, here's the epigenetic version of this.
The DNA is only half the story.
Am I? This is DNA. In your body, it's wrapped around histones. It's a protein. But never mind, it just organizes it within your cells. And the DNA wrapped around a histone makes what's called the epigenome. These little balls here represent chemical tags. The green ones are methyl. When you're exposed to an environmental stress, it has a tendency to cause methyl to deposit on your genome. And that changes the physical structure of your genome. What it'll do is when it's highly methylated, you get what you call compaction. Now imagine you're a gene in the middle of that wrapped up thing. You can't speak anymore. You're silenced and the gene doesn't express itself. When the thing is demethylated, the gene relaxes and can talk again. Right? So, in general, processes like methylation, and there are many others as well, are chemical processes that allow the environment to imprint on your genome so that your genome is constantly reacting to the environment, constantly playing different tunes depending on your environmental exposures. And now I'm going to show you the bulimia equivalent of this. Along here, pretend this is now the keyboard. Okay? It's different regions along one gene, it's the exact same gene I showed you before that helps you accommodate to stress. And this is the level of methylation at different points on that gene. Where you see the arrows and stuff, it means it's higher. This is bulimic women who have a history of suicidality. Okay? So the idea might be that that environmental impact on their genes makes them less able to cope with stress. The tendency is associated with things like childhood abuse or severe stress exposures. Okay? So you can think of that as sort of the way in which your genes learn from the environment. So what are the environmental factors that are involved? And that's what's interesting when it comes to talking about eating disorders. Perinatal and obstetric stress. Okay? The kind of perinatal problems or obstetric complications I showed you before are known to alter methylation in key regions of the genome. To show that it's relevant to eating disorders, anybody here remember the ice storm that happened in, what, 97, I think? Yeah, some of you may be too young to. You know, there was this huge ice storm. Montreal became a foreboding place while a lot of Quebec. Slabs of ice were falling off downtown buildings and injuring people. Roofs were literally caving in. The power grid of Montreal was cut off. If you lived through it, it was a scary experience. With Suzanne King at the dentist, we have a study. She had the brilliant idea of studying the kids who were born of moms who were pregnant during the ice storm. Really stressed out moms, right? And these kids are unusual in a lot of ways. They show stress reactivity problems. Some years ago, I said, Suzanne, let's give them an eating attitudes test. Let's test whether they have eating symptoms. At age 13, these kids show more bulimic symptoms than when their moms were exposed to ice storm stress in the third trimester. There's a whole series of studies that show those kinds of things. Developmental stress. The more you have early life stress, there's a special window where epigenetic markers act. Current stress plays a role, too. And finally, here's where eating disorders are really interesting. Your nutritional state is a very important epigenetic regulator. So dieting becomes like a really important piece in the puzzle of why somebody develops an eating disorder. You might think, you know, early life experience made you kind of vulnerable and you may have genetic susceptibilities, but dieting is fine. You can't get an eating disorder if you don't diet. Anybody here ever go on a, you ever say, I'd like to lose a couple of pounds, I'll diet for a couple of weeks? If you don't all raise your hand, I always thought that Montreal students were an honest crowd. But modest dieting alters brain activity in various ways. It lowers your serotonin levels, various things. It's very directly linked. So if you're already genetically susceptible to mood problems and to other kinds of problems, dieting makes it worse. I got bad news for you ladies. Dieting affects brain activity more in women than in men. And this is true throughout mammalian species. Males resist effects of dietary manipulations on mood and things more than women. And being underweight or malnourished has epigenetic effects. So, okay, how's diet come in? There are certain foods that you could call methyl donors. They're kind of high in folic acid or various other things, but actually, what you eat can impact the amount of methylation that will occur on genes. And we're sort of very interested in studying now what happens when people starve themselves for years on end. What impact might that have on epigenetic processes that control the way their genes work and which genes are talking, do they have stress accommodation genes active or not, that kind of a thing. And there's a whole, you know, wave, I guess, of scientific journals and more lay kind of things that are about the ways in which nutrition can affect genetic effects or gene expression. Okay, so dieting is an important factor. Now comes the MTV piece of this, because that means, I said before, you can't get an eating disorder if you don't diet, right? So one of the key elements is social environments that encourage people to diet. If you don't live in one of those environments, you're not very likely to develop an eating disorder. Well, with sort of a limited comment on that. We'll talk about it later. So I guess we want to look at to what extent can we blame Paris Hilton kind of thing for the development of eating disorders. Just to show the impact of social factors and their importance in terms of eating disorder behavior, let me show you something. I don't know if anybody knows who this is. It's somebody named Ann Becker. Anne is a psychiatrist and an anthropologist. She works at Harvard. She works with us in the Academy for Eating Disorders as well. And she did a very interesting thing when she was doing her doctoral studies in the early 90s. First thing was very smart. She did her doctorate in Fiji. So it was not a bad place to do your doctoral research. But she did another thing, too. She had learned that one of the Fijian islands was going to have American television introduced. I think it was in 1992. She went just prior to the introduction of television and measured the satisfaction with body image, self-esteem, eating behaviors in Fijian women who, I guess you can see in the picture, maybe have a tendency to be a little more solidly built than the average, I guess, North American version of females. These women were delighted with the way they looked. They didn't show any kind of symptoms of eating disturbance. They were really quite well adjusted in terms of self-esteem. She went back 2 years later after the introduction of television. You know what she found? 11% admitted having started purging through vomiting. There was an increase in all kinds of body image preoccupations and eating disorder-related symptoms. Body satisfaction plummeted. So it makes the point that exposure to kind of thin media images and television-related things, magazine culture-related things, can really have an impact. And by the way, you have to know that especially young females, adolescent females especially, are particularly susceptible to those things. You can show a direct connection between the amount of exposure to magazines and models and the amount of dissatisfaction with body image. For which reason, now I'm doing a little commercial. I have a day job, but I also have another job, which is to be co-president of a Quebec government-initiated charter that is about reducing social pressures in the image industries. We've contacted television people, people who are editors of fashion mags, people who run fashion shows, other things. And the idea is not to outlaw thinness, but one of the key themes is to foster a space for diversity so that you can see that people with diverse body images and sizes can be competent, can be effective, can be attractive. You see Christine St-Pierre over there, who's the minister who had, at the time, initiated the project. And I don't know if you know Marie-Claude Savard, who's a media person in Quebec. But I encourage you all to check out the website for this thing. You can all sign on. We have 35,000 signatories in Quebec. It's sort of a Facebook-like thing. You can put up a thing saying, I support this charter because I want, you know, I want to feel good about my body image, or I want my kids to feel good about their body image, that sort of a thing. So that's how you sign on. Did I lose it again? It's going to come back on its own? Okay, well, why don't you all come stand over here and you can see it on the computer. What this slide would show you if you saw was just the trajectory by which genetic effects can be kind of turned on by, genetic effects, you know, you carry genes, you may have susceptibilities that lie dormant until they're switched on or switched off, right? Let's add some obstetric perinatal insults that might just make you vulnerable. Developmental stresses, family dysfunction, traumatic experience perhaps, that sort of a thing, which will further amplify vulnerability. Basic life stress. Anybody in exam periods right now, you are probably, you know, in a state where you're pumping out all kinds of things that are activating stress-related genes. But there's, you know, that might make you generally vulnerable. Now we want to ask the question, why would somebody develop an eating disorder? What's the missing piece here? Something that makes you diet, right? And then we could think about like the actual dieting as being the final trigger to the whole shebang. Okay. Now we're going to talk about so if you want to understand this eating disorders, think biopsychosocially. It's in your DNA. It's in your social environments and in your family to some extent. It's in the social environment that you live in. So it's a truly biopsychosocial thing. I think eating disorders teach us to think that way more than almost anything else. I want you to understand a little bit about how we treat people with eating disorders. Please notice the once upon a time here. You can imagine how easy it was. If you're faced with somebody who's an adolescent and is emaciated, 72 pounds and dropping, various medical things, her electrolytes and her potassium levels are dropping to dangerous levels. Her heart rate is slowing down so much that at night it almost is stopping. It's very easy to move into a kind of anxious, coercive mode where you feel we've just got to fatten her up as quickly as we can. And the old-fashioned solution to that was a nasogastric tube up her nose kind of idea. There was a well-meaning idea that if we can just get her to be re-nourished, the problem goes away. Only problem is this. Hospitalization or other coercive treatments, they can save a life, and we will use them occasionally when people are severely malnourished so that really is a necessary step. They can start the process of the person really re-evaluating what is going on so that you feel that you have to starve yourself. But there is not one lick of evidence to suggest that forcing somebody to gain weight when they're not ready to do so is going to in any way accelerate their recovery from the eating disorder. Okay? So we don't use, I haven't seen a nasogastric tube in about 20 years, and the model that we use is quite different. Here it's going to sound like a commercial for the Douglas Eating Disorder Program. You can see way up there on the top on your right, that's our day hospital and inpatient unit. People are not hooked up to tubes for life support. It's a safe, comfortable, home-like environment in which people can do something that's really hard for them to do when they have an eating disorder, is eat again, risk weight gain, and stuff like that. There's even a garden in the back where people grow vegetables. I always think that's sort of poetic. Our patients eat vegetables that they grow themselves in the back. Over here is our outpatient clinic. So most people we treat will not need the more intensive things. They come here for individual therapy and group therapy, sometimes family work. But if after a certain period of time over in the outpatient clinic, that isn't enough to help somebody unblock what's hanging them up, we can sort of move them over into the other more intensive piece where in our day hospital people come every day of the week, eat their meals together, and also get therapy in between meals and so on. And some people live in that house while they're recovering. So it's kind of a sequential model, we call it, of treatment. You might start in the outpatient clinic. If that does it for you, great. And if not, we step you up. My motto is, I'll do anything as long as it works. You know, so if things aren't sufficient, we move up to more intensive levels of structure. So the main principles we work with aren't about rapid refeeding and forcing people to eat when they're not ready. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The main theme is not coercive. You want to ensure people's safety, you know, make sure that medically the person is not in a dangerous state. And if so, you know, there's relatively rapid ways to stabilize those things. But once the person's safe, put them through an experience that encourages them to reevaluate their beliefs. It's like, what are you thinking when you have to avoid oil in everything or when you feel like you have to run around the block because you just ate? You want people to experiment with new behaviors that put their wrong beliefs about why they can't eat to the test. And my favorite question in therapy is always, is this really in your best interest? You know, I know you don't eat, you don't have to feel, the fear that you feel when you remember the phobia idea that when I eat, you feel that anxiety, you can't concentrate on your studies, you don't want to go out with your friends, but is it getting you where you need to go to continue to avoid? So we work really with thoughts and beliefs that are behind. I don't think people who have eating disorders are crazy. I think they do what they do because they believe they have to. Okay, so let me show you a little bit of what I mean by that kind of stuff. If you're my patient, during the first session we have, or by the end of it, I would like you to have the right answer to what seems like a stupid question. Is this a weight problem? I mean, the source of your distress is your body weight, and losing it is going to be the corrective measure? Or is it a terrible fear of gaining weight? Are you tied down by a massive phobia? Right? Tell me if it works for you. It helps me understand why people with anorexia seem to do such crazy things. It's easy to misunderstand, right? You could say, well, what's wrong with her? Is she suicidal? Is she psychotic? Doesn't she see that she's thin? I understand it as being she's so terrified when she eats that even though she knows she should, it's easy to avoid. Does this metaphor work for you? You know what agoraphobia is, right? If I had agoraphobia, fear of going out of my house, imagine that my house would catch fire, I would run to the front door to save myself, but then at the door kind of go, you know, I really don't know if I can let myself go outside. And that is how I understand what somebody with anorexia nervosa, what they live. They know they have to eat, but when they start to, it's just so awful that it's easy to kind of say, well, I'd just rather not. In the same way, I want you to have the right question. All these things you do, you know, running around the block 7 times after a meal, vomiting 7 times a day. You said you weigh yourself how often? 12 times a day. This is sensible weight control practice, or is this an obsessive compulsive disorder? You know, is this in the same way that somebody obsessively thinks about bacteria and washes their hands compulsively to reduce their anxiety? You think maybe you're doing some of these things compulsively to reduce your anxiety? You think it's in your interest to continue to do that? Or what do you think? Maybe we could work together to try to help you not have to do that any longer. Dietary restraint. People with bulimia always think they're like gluttons or that they have no willpower around food. If you study the eating behavior in somebody who has bulimia, you'll see quite the opposite. She often skips breakfast, tries to get through the through lunch by eating the least amount of calories she can, and then finally tries to have a control around supper, but loses it, right? So it's dietary restraint that is the motor behind her binge eating. It's not only a physical starvation, but restraint is also a psychological thing. Let's test you all. If you say yes to these questions, you are what I would call a psychologically restrictive eater. If I eat a lot one day, I'll try to eat less the next. And we'll make you show your heads, okay? I try to choose only low-calorie foods. If I gain weight, I try to lose it right away. I want the fettuccine Alfredo. I order the salad. If I miss my workout, I feel very guilty. If you say yes to those questions, well, you know, these are kind of socially prescribed values in a way, and so it's common for all of us to uphold them. You know, I must have talked to 40,000 people with bulimia in my lifetime, or maybe I'm exaggerating a bit. Every single one of them would have said yes to all of those questions. And, you know, we can test this in a laboratory. You take somebody who has those kinds of restrictive eating attitudes, you make them eat a little more than they should, or they think they should, they have a binge episode. You get them drunk, they have a binge episode. You make them feel bad about themselves, or like they failed at something, you can trigger a binge episode. So somebody who has bulimia has to learn to manage her emotions, but she has to also change her religion around eating. And by the way, that's why diets fail, because psychological restraint around dieting is very hard to maintain. It sets up compulsive eating. Okay. We teach people various things that might be useful for them to know. Oops. This is, I guess you see the obligatory cartoon. A nurse who's weighing a snowman on a scale. You've lost about 10 pounds, but it's probably just water weight. We practically write this slogan on the walls of our clinic. Rapid weight gain is not real weight gain. If you think about it, if you've been purging 7 or 8 times a day, and I'm convincing enough to get you to stop, all the liquid that winds up in the toilet bowl when you purge is retained in you. You'll gain 7 or 8 pounds within a day. If you're a weight gain phobic, that's a pretty scary experience. So, you know, people have to learn that those little micro fluctuations in weight that you measure when you weigh yourself 12 times a day are not real. You know, you're just measuring changes in water. Why am I showing you this thing? I like people to sort of understand. This is the way I understand set point. I have a strange way of understanding things, I think. Think about water in a swimming pool. That's so that your body is programmed to maintain a certain weight, right? It's going to fluctuate a little bit, but it generally tends to want to stay in the same place. However, if I do all kinds of things to push the little floater down, dieting, vomiting, too much exercise, and then I stop doing those things, what's going to happen? Flows back up, right? People who have eating disorders force their body weight down by doing all kinds of crazy behaviors and then live in constant fear thinking their weight, that they gain weight easily. So, you know, you want to help people. We do what we call cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive means thinking. It's about helping people really look at what is it you're thinking. Are you somebody who gains weight ridiculously rapidly, or are you somebody who has suppressed your weight so low that of course your body fights to go back up to your set point? Now, you can keep it down there by vomiting, by exercising, but are you sure it's in your best interest to do that? Or might it be worth weighing a little more and doing a little bit less of some of this other stuff? Make sense? So that's what cognitive therapy is about, thoughts and beliefs and stuff like that. So I'll just give you, you know, I just went through this one. I gain weight very easily. You know, I would say Martians gain weight very easily. When it comes to people, either dehydrated people gain weight rapidly when they rehydrate, or people whose weight is suppressed, presses up. If I start to eat, I can't stop. Does that mean you're a glutton? This is the reality of somebody who has bulimia nervosa. I guess the question is this because you can't control yourself around food, or when was the last time you had 3 square meals a day, day after day after day? Most of my patients will say, I'm now 25, it was when I was 13. So I guess I'm right in saying you must be a very hungry person, and it's really hard to contain that. You think maybe by relaxing the restraint. So the solution to bulimia is always a paradoxical one. You stop overeating by eating more. If only I can get down to 100 pounds, then I can relax and be happy. Yeah, yeah, I love this one. You see my reaction is like, oh yeah? So this is true. You have gotten to a weight through your starvation that let you finally feel, you know, I'm there, I'm safe, and there's nothing more to worry about. Well, probably not. Or maybe, you know, you weigh now 72 pounds. Was it your intention to weigh 72 pounds? Well, no, I started at 125. I wanted to get down to 120. Well, so what happened? I reached 120, but the minute I got there, I thought, if I eat anything, it's going to go up. And so I couldn't eat, and it dropped even further. And every time it dropped, I was trapped at a lower weight, thinking, if I eat, my weight's going to go up, right? So it goes back to the fear of gaining weight. And you have to help people explore, like, where does this end? When, you know, at what point can you say you've made it, or is it really getting you where you need to go? Okay, I'm talking about eating-related things. We also, of course, you know, people with eating disorders are also people, and we attend to all kinds of other problems they might have. These are my little images to represent depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, alcohol abuse problems, things like that. And so you want to attend to all kinds of stuff. People with eating disorders can sometimes be kind of particular and perfectionistic. And, you know, if I'm perfectionistic, that means the only way I know I'm good enough is I got to be the best at all times, at all things, which is a pretty hard mandate to fill. And if you're a perfectionistic dieter, then how do you know you're not fat? You've got to be the thinnest. And if you know somebody with an eating disorder, you know how much it bugs her to not be the thinnest person in the group or to not be the one who ate less than anybody else around. So her whole system is about regulating how much by always doing too much dieting in this case. And people have to work that out. Mood instability, impulsivity in some people, these are things that we look at in therapy as well. Okay, are there drugs for eating disorders? I guess I've told you a little bit about some of the biology. If for anorexia nervosa, all kinds of things have been tried. I'm a little skeptical about zinc. You know, it's good for batteries, but not for people particularly. There are certain, what we call antipsychotic medications. One is called olanzapine. It works on dopamine, when there's some evidence that reward systems driven by dopamine are involved in anorexia. And it seems to have some benefits for people who especially have a very locked-in anorexia. And then antidepressants just sort of as a way of helping people cope with the mood problems that ensue. But there's no real med for anorexia nervosa. In bulimia nervosa, lots of things have been tried. What tends to stand out is things that act on the serotonin system. You know, a lot of antidepressants work on serotonin. I mentioned before that serotonin regulates mood, impulses, social behavior to a certain extent, but also satiety. So if I have bulimia, it can be helpful to just boost my serotonin activity by using meds as a sort of adjunct. It's not treatment, but it's an adjunct. And I don't know if you've heard about this. There's actually some new findings that show that deep brain stimulation, actually implanting certain electrodes in certain key regions of the brain, subgenual cingulate is where people tend to plant them, can actually, you know, there's some emerging data that it helps unlock the very, very chronic and severe forms of anorexia nervosa that sometimes occur. It may seem very draconian and intrusive, but if you've known anybody who has severe anorexia, you might know somebody who was hospitalized 15 times between the age of 14 and 23, each year getting fattened up in hospital and then losing weight and going through that cycle year after year after year, which makes life unlivable. If a relatively non-intrusive, this is a very fine wires that are implanted in the brain, can help. It's sometimes a solution to what's not a very livable life. The research in this kind of stuff is really in its infancy, but there's some promising results. We're doing some results with something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which means it's a magnetic field that you apply from the outside of the skull. It has no surgery or intrusion. It's harmless. And there's some evidence that it can help reduce the urge to binge or some of the anxiety around eating. So let me just make a few comments, and then I hope we'll have time to talk and you'll have some questions and stuff. Generally, what can you say about the treatment outcome or what happens to people with anorexia? In anorexia, outcome in adolescence tends to be pretty good. The majority of adolescents, if we can get in there quickly, seem to respond well to treatment. And family intervention is often a main component, just because it's appropriate in young adolescents especially. As I said before, we train the parents how to talk around the meal situation in a way that doesn't sort of piss off the daughter so much that she says, I don't feel like eating anymore, but that actually helps remind her that that you're avoiding eating because it's so phobic, and maybe we'd like to help you sort of face the thing you fear and keep you calm around it. Outcome in adults tends to be a little more guarded, and we don't know exactly why. Maybe it could be because after having a chronic eating disorder, think about all the effects of epigenetics and stuff on your on the way your genes are expressing themselves. You get a deterioration in functioning, so it locks you in further and further. Or maybe certain forms of eating disorders are so severe that they persist into adulthood, and in adolescent groups we don't see only that form. We're still searching for the best treatment for anorexia. I can't claim that we or any other group in the world has a surefire, guaranteed cure kind of treatment. Although the outcome is pretty good. If you follow people out 30, 40 years, what we do see is that more and more and more people recover with time. So my motto is you never give up, and nobody has to accept to live with anorexia nervosa. There's all kinds of solutions, but it means persistence and struggling for some people. For bulimia, cognitive behavioral therapy, that's CBT, really works. The majority of people respond well to it. Adding meds to that may make it even more powerful. That's all I would say about that. So in anorexia, the outcome, as I mentioned, is a little bit guarded. About half of people get up to what we would call a good adjustment, which means minimally normal weight again, being a little more functional. People tend to have ongoing preoccupations in about two-thirds of cases, though. One in five will relapse within 2 years. But I see relapse as part of it's a bit like in the treatment of addictions or other things. It's a step towards recovery for many people. And as I mentioned before, the longer you follow people, the better the outcome picture gets. So it's worth sticking it out. Anorexia does, however, have the highest mortality rate of any mental health problem. As you see there, 6 to 20% mortality is reported across studies. Some of those exaggerate and are not well-conducted studies. I think realistically, the figure you can trust is about 5% of people per decade will eventually die of anorexia nervosa. Unfortunately, half due to the effects of malnutrition, half due to suicide, because it becomes so unlivable. The other side of the coin, though, is that the vast majority of people, and in good treatment, nobody needs to die of this thing. Bulimia, I mentioned, it has a much better outcome picture, full recovery in 50%, 75% after 20 years don't show any more eating disorder. Mortality rate is almost zero for bulimia, and there are very few strong things that predict outcome. Okay. Let me just make one last comment and then we'll talk. What I want you to take out of this, we'll go back to DNA, TLC, MTV. We used to think of eating disorders as a sociocultural creation, right? But there's been an increasing recognition of the role of biology and heredity in the eating disorders. But it's kind of interesting. Despite that, treatment still remains largely relationship-based. It's interpersonal. We use a principle which we call autonomy support. It's very much about, as a therapist, acting in a way that makes people feel an inner desire to start changing some of their behaviors. So it's really psychotherapy that's still the key. I would say biologically informed models, though, paradoxically, they kind of humanize therapy. Instead of pointing fingers at people like, you know, you are a capricious, superficial, manipulative young lady, or pointing at their fingers at families as though they were responsible for causing this disorder, there's a whole other understanding, which is that we're talking about people who carry real susceptibilities that become even more real because they get switched on by the environment. I have a phrase I often say to people when I'm during the first evaluation. It's like, no, you don't have to be ashamed of your eating disorder, and it's not your fault. You were walking along the sidewalk when the movers dropped the piano. You know, it landed on you. Your job is to sort of take care of the damage, but it isn't because of weakness or a lack of sort of moral strength. So these kinds of things blame patients less, and we don't understand eating disorders as resulting from parental failures anymore, and that sort of thing. Our clinical approach, as I guess I hope I've sort of conveyed to you, we've moved from very coercive treatments to an emphasis on getting people autonomously motivated to change. And we do backflips, for example, involuntary hospitalization. Haven't done that we did one in the last 10 years. So we'll do anything we can to sort of bring people to really saying, you know, it's scary and it's hard for me, but I think it's a good idea for me to start confronting my fears of eating and start to eat again. Okay? So that's it for today.
Howard, thank you. That's a beautiful overview. And I will review the question procedure. You write your questions on cards. I think you know the drill. You hand it to one of our medical students, who are these nice people in red shirts, who are about to get up and run around and collect the questions. They'll bring them down, and we'll get rolling on the questions. Your mic works.
Yeah, it's working. Good.
Okay. We have lots of questions coming, but I can't see them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You want to be
questions? Yeah, I do. I know.
Master of questions?
Oh, yeah, okay. Ah! Somebody really took methylation to heart and wants to know. You have to listen to the question, and you'll appreciate the answer. Just write them down. Don't whisper to each other and scribble quietly. How many still own a pencil? Or a pen? I figure not many do anymore because you have computers, right? Okay, Howard. What are the main groups that release methyl in the body? Is that an issue that these young people should think about?
Yeah, interesting question. First off, I'm going to say something really disappointing, which is we're not at a stage where we can even think of something like nutritional therapies or helping people know which foods they ought to eat in order to regulate some of these processes better. This is a really new area for research that is just burgeoning now. But I won't be so evasive. Methyl. It's very, very... The most methyl-rich foods tend to be dark green leafy vegetables. Those are things that are high in methyl. You saw some of the things on my picture. Oysters are methyl donors. Liver, if you are so inclined. And red wine. So once a little bit of wine can get you there when it comes to methyl. But we really can't predict that it's going to have any particular beneficial effect. When you have an eating disorder, it's not what you eat, it's do you eat. You know, we're not so concerned with people's nutritional stability, we just want them to start eating again and facing food. In the same way, if I was a dog phobic, it wouldn't matter that much which breed of dog I patted. I should just start patting dogs.
Here's a really neat question. There are a lot of great questions. Should women get epidurals during childbirth to reduce the risk of their children having anorexia nervosa because that would reduce mother's stress during childbirth? Wow.
Hmm. very clever. In fact, maybe you can answer this question better
than
me.
I think, I'm guessing now, but Dr. Steiger will correct me, when he was talking about stress, he meant during intrauterine development. He wasn't talking about the physical stress of childbirth, because the childbirth is more a physical stress than it is a psychological stress. And there's a lot of work to show that if you have pain and a good cause, right, your pain and the joy of having a child, then that pain isn't the same as having pain after surgery. So I don't think epidurals will make a difference, but epidurals are used for a variety of reasons. Some women want them, they discuss them with their obstetrician, other women don't. But I think the stress that Dr. Steiger was talking about is the stress to a woman over a number of weeks or months, that is from family abuse. If a husband is abusing a pregnant wife, the stress on her system reflected in the hormonal changes, the stress hormones, those may have a bad effect on the woman herself and the infant or the fetus she's carrying. So it's not a childbirth question, it's stress over a period of weeks or months.
And yes, indeed, that is the right answer to the question. You want to think into this. Some really nice studies by various people, I'm thinking of a guy named Overlander who studies that. Moms who are depressed, for example, or very stressed, if you think about it, as Dr. Fuchs was saying, the infant is constantly being exposed to the mother's cortisol, to her stress hormones. Right. And so that interacts with the fetus's nervous system, changing the, sort of programming the way it's going to operate with a lasting effect. Some of these studies show very interesting changes. You know, infants of moms who were stressed show increased stress reactivity, hypermethylation of that same glucocorticoid receptor gene that I was showing you about before, the stress gene, things like that. There's also, just on that same note, you know, I talked about the ice storm studies. There's studies that Rachel Yehuda has conducted on moms who were pregnant in close proximity to ground zero, 911. And we have similar kinds of things. So it's not momentary stress, but being exposed to prolonged periods of stress during pregnancy.
Okay. Here's a very interesting question again. Is the person with anorexia aware that she will have health problems because of her behavior? And it's an interesting kind of philosophic issue, huh?
Initially, perhaps not, but invariably, if the anorexia persists, you know, people bump their nose against health problems very often. And as I mentioned to you before, it's not a kind, you know, people think people with anorexia see themselves as fat when they're thin. Not true. They know they're thin. People with anorexia deny the consequences of the illness. Not true either, although sometimes they can be so invested in not eating that other things don't matter so much. And as I mentioned to you before, just think, if you, every time you ate, you had to spend the rest of the day worrying about what you ate, feeling fat, unable to concentrate, you might just opt not to eat too, especially if you had an important exam that day or something, right? So you know it's not good for you, but in the moment it's easy to make the choice to avoid.
So if we talk about the media contributing to the increase in anorexia, like Fiji and maybe North America, are there records of anorexia or bulimic patients before the media were so important? In other words, how old is this illness?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, and a very interesting question. I'm glad you asked it. I didn't have time to sort of get into it before. There's some very surprising things about the eating disorders. Anorexia nervosa is surprisingly less attached to the culture of thinness as we once thought. Anorexia exists around the world, in cultures that don't have any kind of particular value placed on thinness. It existed throughout history. The first medical reports, William Gull is one of them, was in the 1600s. No, Gull is later. Somebody reported them in 1600. I forget who it is. And there's even, you know, Renaissance treatises that suggest that we're describing anorexia.
Yes.
So anorexia, it's a, you know, I think we have come to understand it as an expression of distress that is particularly characteristic of females, but that can exist without the dieting. Interestingly, bulimia, overeating, is something that is on the increase in cultures that put more and more emphasis on thinness and seems to only be localized to those cultures that put a real emphasis on thinness. It's an interesting thing. If you think about it, during the last decades when we're increasingly conscious of wanting to be thin and dieting, what do we have? An epidemic of obesity, you know, increasing obesity. So to me, that bulimia is the natural response of a population when you expose, when you put too much pressure on people to stay thin and to diet, to force their bodies below the weight that, you know, God meant you to have. Don't worry, I'm not going religious on you.
Are there certain racial groups that are more prone to eating disorders than others? In other words, is there some kind of genetic background that's racial, in the good sense of racial, Asian or European or Caucasian or so on? Is there some connection there?
Yeah, there are some connections, but not as many as you would think. Eating disorders really cut across all kinds of ethnic and socioeconomic boundaries, by the way. They're not just things that occur in, you know, she tennis club going girls. But to get back to the question, anorexia nervosa seems to occur somewhat less frequently in black populations. Some evidence to suggest that Asian populations are a little less susceptible. Bulimia cuts across all ethnic groups. Maybe, as in most disorders that have to do with mood disturbance and stuff, actually is found in economically less favored kind of communities, things like that.
Here's a very, you know, forward-looking question. Can eating disorders be treated or cured with gene therapy?
That's a very forward-looking question. I mean, I don't know that they can, and people are thinking about it. What the epigenetic stuff on it, though, is very interesting, because there you can really think of the possibility, again, science fiction kind of theorizing, but you can think in terms of pharmacological interventions. If the problem is too much methylation of a certain region of the genome, if you can demethylate biochemically, you can do something. A lot of treatments for cancers work through those kinds of pathways. People are starting to work on things like that for mental health problems. Think of nutrition therapy. You know, maybe there would be a way of altering people's food intake such that it has benefits. But it's totally sci-fi. I don't know.
If you're suffering from one of the eating disorders, from whom do you get treatment? Psychiatrists, other healthcare professionals? If you say phobia, what kind of professionals help treat such individuals?
I mean, generally speaking, I hope I've conveyed to you that eating disorders are complex things and they have many, many causal factors. They're bio, psycho, social. And as a result, the preference for treatment is multimodal and multidisciplinary. In our program, for example, we have several psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, occupational therapists, nurses, nursing assistants, I'm trying to think if I forgot anybody, counseling people. We don't have an accountant. You know, we have all other professional groups. So one thing eating disorders teach us also is that it's not so much about a particular profession as much as people developing real expertise in understanding why people don't eat, knowing how to talk to them to help them start again. So our approach in our team is very what you call transdisciplinary. People's disciplines get a little bit erased in that kind of thing. You have to know what you're doing around eating disorders. I've become a pretty good nutritionist in the process of working with these things.
This is a public service announcement. Whoever asked the question about gene therapy also left their trigonometry homework on the back of the card. And 1.61 is 700 nanometers, and anyways, if you need your homework back, come down and fetch it. So, someone wants to know whether being a vegetarian is a disorder. Depends how few vegetables you eat, right?
Exactly. You know, it's interesting, but no, of course not. You know, vegetarianism is allowed, and it's a free choice. But you know what? About 80% of people who have anorexia nervosa have a preference for vegetables. Now, sometimes it may be a well-founded dietary choice based on ethical values or other things, health concerns. Often, we don't want to jump to conclusions, but I guess I want to leave a mind open to the idea that maybe it's because vegetables feel a lot safer when you're kind of fat phobic or fearful of losing control over those things. So I like Dr. Fuchs' answer. It depends how many vegetables you eat.
So yesterday there was a wonderful lecture in the public science series, and the speaker, Dr. Caulfield from Edmonton, said that good nutrition means that we get half our calories every day from fruits and vegetables. So that's a great idea to know about. That doesn't mean you have to be vegetarian, but you need to get a certain amount of the calories from fruits and vegetables. Everyone thinks, oh, well, we all know about that, right? But no one does it. So it's something to think about.
If I can just inject a comment, too. I want you to appreciate how severe it can get. I've been talking recently with one of my patients. It's a guy I'm following who was doing well for a while, and then due to various kind of stressors he went through, sort of slipped back into his anorexia. He's gotten to the point where his girlfriend came with him the other day and said, I can only get him to eat one pear a day. And by the next time I saw him, he was allowing himself two sips of coffee and throwing up the second one. So it gets to the point where it becomes the person loses proportion but just feels terrified if they eat anything at all at a certain point.
The two really, combined, these two questions are interesting. On the one hand, if we focus on the genetic reasons, as you already mentioned, that might contribute to the disorder, not cause it, wouldn't it make people think that they're less responsible for their problem and therefore make it harder to treat? Right? Mm-hmm. They don't take responsibility.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting notion, and that certainly was, when I, the tradition I came from in my training as psychotherapist was really one of trying to make people assume responsibility and pay attention to the choices. And I would say things like, not eating is a choice, young lady. You know what? It's not a choice when you have anorexia nervosa. It's something that is so compelling that people who have sound minds and the will to recover can't resist it. So I think it's more respectful and helpful. Let me back up in my thinking. One of the symptoms of an eating disorder is invariably shame. People always feel like, what's wrong with me? Why do I have to do this? If you're an adult, it's like you should have gotten over this when you were an adolescent. It's a really awful experience. So I think it's less shame-provoking to help people understand that it's not weakness. You developed your eating disorder because you carry a real vulnerability to it, and things turned it on. And now this work is about turning it off. One of the things you have to do to turn it off is not be starved anymore.
So this gives you a chance to clarify something for the crowd. If we said yes to all the questions on the self-test, does that mean it's bad? In other words, does that mean we have an eating disorder?
I am appreciative of the opportunity to clarify a misconception I may have created. That's a whole debate, in fact, in our field. There's the idea that restraint, I call our clinic the Church of Non-Restraint. We kind of lean against a whole social tidal wave of pressures to control what you eat, to weigh less than you're probably programmed to weigh, and stuff like that. So there is certainly a value, or there's an ideology around the idea of letting go of dietary restraint and living at the weight that your body was programmed to have. However, there is also such a thing as adaptive restraint for people who need to control body weight, who have weight gain problems and so on. But it's really a debate because it's not that clear that actually restricting your calorie intake gets you to be able to achieve any kind of lasting weight loss. And I'm kind of tipping towards, that's not the way to go.
If it reassures whoever asked the question, I said yes to those, and I don't have an eating disorder. So there are two ways to, right? So there's two ways to look at this. One is to say, if you have an eating disorder, are you likely to say yes to those? And the answer is yes. But the converse isn't necessarily the same. If you say yes, that by itself doesn't mean you're going to have an eating disorder, right? That's so true. A lot of people have stress, and some people react in certain ways, other people react in other ways. So there are ways in which we learn to react to our environment. So saying yes is by itself, as someone said, is that bad? And the answer is no, it's not bad. Now, we always have a question about, I have a friend who, right? And that's okay. So this person wants to know, how can I help my friend feel better about her body image? And I presume somebody knows somebody who may have an eating disorder, and the question is, what is a friend or sibling to do? How can he or she help?
There's a lot of things that friends can do to help. Friends are very important when you have an eating disorder. Let's look at the bigger picture first. What I would always encourage people to do is to have the courage to speak openly about your concerns if you see somebody looking like they have an eating disorder. Not with a blamey finger, like you're not eating enough and look what you're doing, but more like, I'm kind of concerned, I see you looking like you're very uncomfortable around meals. Is it true? Is it something we could talk about? Have an openness to hearing what the person's experience is. If you know some helpful information that might help, like where do you recommend that they consult to get an assessment or help? Our clinic is a good place for that if you don't know of others. There's also an organization called ANEB. I don't know if you know it. It's the Anorexia Nervosa and Bulimia Association, which offers great self-help groups and things. And it's a really nice non-threatening start for somebody who has an eating disorder, because you can go and talk to other people who have eating disorders and really learn from their experience without it being like in front of a scary professional like me. So that kind of stuff. But here's the other big rule. You have to respect people's readiness to take it on and to change. Don't expect them to be different on your agenda, right? That's true for us therapists, and it's true for friends too. People overcome their eating disorders when they are prepared to do so. Otherwise, how do you help people have a healthier body image? I mean, we got to really, as a society, redo our whole thinking about our relationship with body and food. That's why I'm involved in that body image charter. We can actually sort of rethink, is it really always better to be thinner rather than heavier? And how much cash do we want to put on those things?
Someone discovered another form, which many of us know. How can we stop the act of eating a lot when feeling sad or bored? And this person calls this emotional hunger.
Yeah. I mean, there are, usually bulimia, for example, has usually two motors. One is too much dieting, starving, needing to eat, and the other is emotional eating. So in that respect, you're talking about learning to be attentive to your own emotional states, learning how to tolerate distress and let it kind of pass through, how to read the signs so that it isn't interpreted as hunger or something else that should be more correctly read as a real emotion and that you respond to. And those are the kind of things we do in therapy, is really helping people get tuned into, like, what were you feeling at that moment that triggered the binge type of stuff.
So here's the question of someone who's interested in banking. Can people gain weight when not eating?
Can people gain weight by not eating? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, you can not gain weight by not eating, no. But I think you can make yourself susceptible to weight gain by doing too much dietary restraint. There are some metabolic effects that can come into play, but if you just think of the direct connection between too much restriction and the tendency to lose control or to get into compulsive eating, too much restraint causes overeating and weight gain. I'm pretty convinced of that.
So part of this also comes from the story that says, hey doc, I don't eat a thing and I gain weight. You've heard that, right? I've certainly heard it. And so that's when I used the banking story. All of you have a bank account, right? So if you ever seen that you don't put in any money, the bank account grows? Not much, right? Interest rates are zip. So if you don't eat, you don't gain weight. So weight control has to do with the same thing as your bank account. You want the account to get smaller, you put in less, that is, you eat less, or you take up more, you exercise. So that's weight control and banking. You heard it here. All right.
And to balance against that one, I would just say, let's remember the idea that if you think you're a person who gains weight rapidly, are you a person who maintains your weight at your naturally endowed weight, or are you prone to always keeping your weight too low? That's what causes any kind of eating to cause weight gain.
There's an interesting question I didn't think of at all. Can dieting be related to Alzheimer's disease, since it seems to affect brain activity?
I don't know. Maybe you know.
Never heard of it. Never heard of it. When you're talking about dieting to that extreme, in other words, there is a point, and Dr. Steiger talked about it, when the dieting or the anorexia is so extreme that your heart rate goes down to 45, it's quite dramatic. And someone asked the question, is it due to suicide or starvation? And you mentioned it's a combination, some of the effect. So I myself don't think that dieting has any connection to Alzheimer's. No one really knows for sure the mechanisms, although it's thought to be due to the deposition of certain proteins in the brain. In any event, eating disorders do not occur at the age range when Alzheimer's does. So I don't think it's connected. Now, there's a very important question. What are the dangers and problems of taking substances which cut your appetite?
Manyfold, I work with a lot of people who do that. First of all, anything, your body is a really intelligent machine designed to make you nourish it. And so anything you do chemically or otherwise that alters appetite regulation mechanisms means that your body mounts a counter reaction to it. So in general, there's usually a rebound after cutting appetite with stimulants or stuff like that. People wind up eating more afterwards. That's one aspect of it. But all of these things are remarkably detrimental to health in general. They affect, cardiac function, cognitive function, judgment, and so on. So they're not good things to take.
Don't use them. And don't use them to stay awake for exams. And don't use them to stay awake to study. Those are drugs of abuse. Full stop.
A lot of it's become very trendy to misuse attention deficit kind of medications, Adderall,
yes,
stuff like that. I've seen people put themselves in terrible medical crises, playing around with things like that. The other thing that's a real popular appetite suppressant in the new era is energy drinks, Red Bull, stuff like that, and. I tend to talk quickly, as you may have noticed, but some of my patients talk about this rate because they drink about 7 or 8 Red Bulls, and that's another kind of stimulant-related thing they do.
Have a cup of tea instead. Finally, how old is the youngest person you have treated for anorexia?
I run an adult program. So, if my honest answer to the question would be, I treat people who are 18 and up, and in other settings I've seen people who are teenagers, but I've known of people who develop what look to be full-blown eating disorders at the age of 7 or 8 or 9 in the extreme.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's rare, but it does happen.
Okay. Dr. Steiger, thank you really very much. A great hand to Peter. Thank you for taking the time and giving us so much information. It's really terrific and valuable to all of us. I remind you that next week we have another lecture, same time, same station. You are welcome to come down, a few of you, not a huge number. Dr. Steiger will answer questions till 8:15, And then he turns into a pumpkin. So come on down, and thank you for being here, and safe travel home.